aliens and flying saucers.
This is all an illusion.
Hey, Chaka Khan, and welcome to the 20th episode of Two Writers Slinging Yang. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm a former Sports Illustrated senior writer, former ESPN columnist, author of multiple New York Times bestsellers, and a columnist for The Athletic. The music you're listening to is Croissant's Master by the great MC White Owl, and this podcast is an ode to writing in all its forms, from journalism to songwriting to screenwriting to novel to romance to comics to whatever enters my head. And today's guest is Jack McCallum, my former Sports Illustrated colleague and one of the all-time great basketball writers. Jack is the author of a new book, Golden Days, that weaves in the 1971-72 Lakers with the modern-day Golden State Warriors. He's written a bunch of other books, including the blockbuster Dream Team on the 92 Men's Olympic basketball squad. Today we're going to dig into covering hoops, how to write breezily, and that's a bigger skill than many of you would think, and whether Michael Jordan should have actually bagged it. All right now, on Two Writers Slinging Yang. First of all, thank you for doing this very much. And I want you to know I have two of your books in front of me right now. I have your new book, Golden Days, and I also have a little book, and I'm confused why this does not appear on your website, a little book called Shaq Attack.
Yes.
And I don't know if you, you probably remember this. First time I ever talked to you, I was a writer for the Tennessean, and I was doing a story about sports books. And
I remember this story. Of course I do.
I called to ask you how much of the book Shaq wrote and how much of the book you wrote, and you laughed at me. And that was
crazy. I remember that specifically, and I said, "What are you talking about? I wrote all of it." You know, I did run it, and you subsequently found out. Although I don't think you've ever done you do mostly third person
right.
Bios, but the important thing is to get, you know, the subject involved. I mean, to make sure the subject reads the language, and you know, all the information comes from the subject. You interview, tape, you know, but it's as you have found out undoubtedly, Jeff, it's an arduous task writing a book.
Yeah.
And it's just not, you know, a bad book, a mediocre book, or whatever kind of book isn't easy. So to ask an athlete to do it, I mean, there's been cases, you know, Bill Bradley wrote his book, but then again, he ran for president. So,
right.
You know, right. It's a whole different thing. But I remember that conversation with the young Jeff Perlman.
Wait, so basically ghostwriting a book means you shove a tape recorder in front of a guy, get as much stuff as you can from him, and then try writing in his voice. Is that the basic approach?
Yeah, but I mean, it goes kind of beyond that. I'm not suggesting it's, you know, to use the cliche, you know, brain surgery or rocket science. I mean, you do the research. I mean, you're the one usually that has to come up with what you want to talk about. I mean, you know, you're responsible for plumbing the subject's memory. You don't go, okay, the first game was against the Knicks. What do you remember? You got to say, you know, the first game he had 27-13 and you and Patrick Ewing got into a little tussle in the first period. You know, you have to do the responses because not everybody's memory about their own life is, you know, mine certainly wouldn't be. So you're doing research and then you're doing taping and then you're converting it into their language. Then you're showing them and reconverting it after they say, hey, man, I didn't sound like that, or let's change that, or that's wrong.
Right. Well, I just remember being shocked. I must have been the most naive human being of all time because I remember being shocked that athletes did these books, but they really had almost no, you know, there was no typewriter. There's no Shaq with a pen pondering, you know, life's literary meaning. It was just Jack McCallum in the shadows writing the book. There's no Santa Claus, I've learned. I was reading Golden Days, and I have to say, in a cliche, I'm about halfway through, and I'm fascinated by many things when it comes to writing a book. And the one that I really am interested in here is you're weaving. You're taking two completely and totally different teams from different eras, and weaving them into sort of one book, and that seems really, really hard to me. Like, writing is hard, researching is hard, all that stuff is hard. But taking two subjects that are, you know, from completely different eras and weaving them into something seems almost mind-jarringly difficult to me. Am I exaggerating the difficulty?
Well,
of that?
My idea, that didn't come to me right away. I wanted to write. I was listening to a Doors album, believe it or not, and L.A. Woman. You know, we were doing this email exchange about groups that we didn't like, but we kind of liked one song. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was L.A. Woman. I think it's just one of the great, great songs, evocative of the, you know, early 70s. And that was my suggestion. And I said, hey, what year did that come out? And it came out in 71, mm-hmm. which was the year I began journalism. And then I began, you know how you waste time on the internet. I began researching other things that were going on then. And sports-wise, it was the year I began working. I graduated from college. And one of the things going on in the sports world was the Lakers' 33-game winning streak, which just boggled my mind.
Right.
That a team won 33 straight games at a point when they were traveling commercial, you know, getting up and taking a plane, going to Chicago, playing that night, getting in the plane the next day. I mean, it is mind-boggling to me. And it had Jerry West, it had Wilt Chamberlain, had Elgin Baylor, three of the great players of all time and interesting personalities. So my idea was to do a book about that and wrote a proposal. And the publisher said, well, at the same time, the Warriors were on their long winning streak, the 2015-16 season. Mm-hmm. So it was the publisher's idea kind of, hey, maybe we could make it also more modern and bring in this other team. And I said, well, we were even luckier than we thought because Jerry West was an advisor, a member of the ownership council, and a trusted kind of, member of the hierarchy at that time. So I can link these two eras together and kind of use Jerry West as the prism. So that's kind of how it came about.
And so what's your first step here? Do you reach out to Jerry West early? And do you have to convince him this is a project worth doing? Do you have a long relationship with him? Like, how do you go about it?
Well, yeah, that was the first one here. I mean, I have a long relationship with Jerry, but it's not like, I knew him back in the 80s. I mean, used to interview him, but it's not like I call, hey, Jerry, it's Jack. You know, that doesn't work that way. And in the beginning, I didn't know if it was going to work. I mean, I didn't know whether it was a long, what we used to call at Sports Illustrated, a bonus piece.
Right.
I didn't know whether it was that. This is way back before before I added on the Warriors component. I didn't know whether it was a book or a long story. So I arranged an interview with Jerry West. I remember it was Mother's Day on 2015, mm-hmm. Mother's Day of 15. And it was so fascinating just hearing him talk. I mean, I started to explain it to Jerry, but he just kind of starts talking. To this day, I'm not sure that he knows after, several interviews with him and this entire book, I'm not sure. I would always start to explain to him what my idea was, and we'd just start talking about stuff. So after I got done with Jerry, I, had all this fascinating stuff. I finally got to Elgin Baylor, who was a little reluctant to talk, but I finally got him.
Why was he reluctant?
Well, I mean, I think Elgin, maybe it was more, it was more his wife a little bit. His wife is kind of the caretaker of the Elgin legend, and she is pissed off, rightly so, about any number of things, one of them being that his relationship with the Lakers, is not very good, what it should be. Mm-hmm. They started building all these statues. The first damn statue they should have built was Elgin Baylor.
Right.
You know, he made the team when they went to L.A. And for whatever variety of reasons, that has not happened, does not look like it will happen. So, this general disorientation from the league, I mean, he was Donald Sterling's general manager and failed in his lawsuit against the abhorrent Donald Sterling.
Right.
So I just think a general feeling of bitterness, although let me say, when I talked to Elgin finally, he doesn't seem bitter. And maybe that's part of Elgin's personality. We had a great conversation. So after I had West in the bank for 2 hours and 2 hours of Elgin Baylor, I said, man, I really like this Lakers idea. But then the Warriors came into it. They got Kevin Durant. They lost the championship, but they got Kevin Durant. So by definition, they became this incredibly interesting team, you know. So therefore, I kind of had both sides of it and began researching, kind of gone on and off between talk to some old Lakers, go get some new Warriors. Talk to some old Lakers, get some new Warriors. Always looking for the, you know, the kind of similarities between them without pounding that over the head when the similarities weren't there, because the contrasts are as stark as the similarities are.
Do you find it hard? So I recently did a story for Bleacher Report about Sam Darnold, the USC quarterback, and I sort of sat in the room and thought, I have nothing in common with this guy, and I don't really feel like I have that much to say to him because of the age gap between me and the college, you know, sophomore. The guys you wrote about for the Lakers, you know, they're sort of contemporaries or a little older. The guys you wrote about for the Warriors are, you know, in their 20s. Did you find it hard, or do you find it hard to sort of relate, interview, get on the level of a guy who's Steph Curry, who's 27 years old or whatever he is? Is that tough at all?
Yeah, of course you do. And you begin more conscious of this. I think I started to feel it when I remember interviewing when LeBron first came into the league. It was whatever year that was, and I was assigned to do the preview story. And I'm talking to LeBron, and I'm, you know, it used to be one thing when I was talking to Michael Magic Larry, who knew me, and I was only a little bit older than them. I was almost always older than everybody. I mean, I got to SI when I was 30 or 31. You were probably a little younger, I guess, right?
Yeah, I was 25, I think, or 26.
Yeah, I mean, most of the time I was older than people. Not always, and you weren't always older than the coaches. You know, that was your sort of your, a lot of times why the traditional male white sports writer, you know, whatever disadvantages he had with the young black athlete, they were probably counterbalanced by the advantages he had talking to the white, you know, authority figures, the owners, the general managers, and the coaches.
Right.
That's kind of a different question, what you're saying. But I think if, you know, I mean, for me, when I interviewed Curry and Durant and the other guys on the team, first of all, you got to know your stuff. And secondly, I always sort of did throw around, you know, I'm still on the Sports Illustrated masthead. Raymond Ritter, the Golden State Warriors PR guy, would introduce me as a Sports Illustrated guy. Kevin Durant, I covered a little bit. He remembered a story I did because I did the first story on Kevin for Sports Illustrated. So the answer to the question is yes, you do feel it, certainly. You know, you're now 50 years older. I am than some of the people.
So weird.
But I think there's ways around it. If you know what you're talking about, you can do it. Even if you're thinking, the guy might be thinking, God damn, this guy is old.
Right. You know? Right.
But it kind of plugs into Jerry West, because Jerry is going on 80. And one of the things I write about in the book was interesting to me, how Jerry still relates. And he does. It's not a fake. Jerry still relates to it because of the fact that he can impart his knowledge, that he knows things that they don't know, and he is able to do it without a kind of, hey, look how we did it in my day.
Right.
You know, he doesn't do that like a lot of other athletes do. I really admire that about him, and that's largely why he's been able to stay relevant, I think.
You know, it's interesting. I recently had an editor say to me, I won't name the editor or the place, that he was going with younger writers because they could go into a locker room and talk to the players. And this guy was talking to me. I'm 45 years old. And I hate that. Like, I feel like you could go into a locker room, whatever, in your late 60s, me in my mid 40s. I feel like if you know your stuff and you know the topic and you know how to interview people, you know, and you have those tools, it's a lot more valuable than a 22-year-old who can drop a Drake lyric every now and then. I don't know, but do you think there is something to be said for the sort of contemporary element of being able to interview someone just based on contemporary, you know, time period?
I guess initially, I mean, I don't know. If I put myself in the shoes of a black athlete, I'm 25 years old. Mm-hmm. Maybe I've had experiences anyway that haven't been completely, you know, copacetic with white authority figures. Maybe. I mean, I don't know. And then Jack McCallum heads towards you.
Right.
You know, instead of Mark Spears heading toward you. Is there a moment when Mark Spears would have an advantage? I'm just throwing out Mark Spears. There's John Abrams. There's hundreds. There's Jay Adandi. There's hundreds. Right. Would there be a moment when they feel more comfortable than me coming? I suppose that's possible. Just as like an owner or an older coach might feel more comfortable if I was heading toward them. I just think you overcome that pretty quickly, along with the fact that I really do believe the NBA for just the longest time has been better at kind of fostering a sort of equality between races and ages and genders that other, well, there's only two genders.
Right.
Well, actually, probably not now.
Yeah, right.
Has done a better job. Traditionally, there's a history of that that exists that I think you go through it less. That's just my guess.
Right.
You know, but I've never felt I couldn't talk to young black athletes, but I couldn't say for a moment there isn't a moment when I'm coming toward them, and the older I look,
right,
the more they might want to talk to someone who looks more like them. But you know what? Honestly, I think they overcome it in 30 seconds. And the other thing that happens is that, not that I would ever do this during an interview, but like, I'm the guy that covered Jordan. I'm the guy that covered Magic. I'm the guy that covered Bird. And in some level, guys like Curry and Durant, I'm just picking them out for two. They know that. You know, they know sort of where I came from. Like Bob Ryan shows up. I mean, Bob Ryan, you know, is older than I am with grayer hair. But they know who Bob Ryan is. They know that he, you know, is a Hall of Fame writer who, you know, went back with Bob Cousy. And in some sense, I think they accept that. That's what I believe anyway. Could be too rosy of an opinion, but I do believe that.
No, I think I agree with you. I really do. You have one of the most unique writing styles. When I was reading your book, there's a passage here. I'm just going to read it real quick. You wrote, tougher than a Cossack and blessed with natural talent. West was hip. West was cool. West was even, in a strange way, Hollywood. His size, a legit 6'3" with a massive wingspan, surprised people when they met him. He had a kind of countrified raw bone strength about him. He didn't have movie star good looks, but rather the face of a hard extra, someone who tumbled downstairs, dusted himself off, and went back looking for more. So I've always thought, and I know you feel the same way, like when we were at SI, there were certain people you could recognize just by their writing. Like, you wouldn't need to see the byline of Steve Rushen or Rick Riley or Bill Mack, and you knew they wrote that story. And I always felt you had I thought immediately recognizable, because you had this real casual way of writing. And which I've envied for years, like this breezy, you know, almost like I'm taking a walk and here's what I see. And this is kind of how it is. And, you know, the Lakers are going to be good this year because it just came off as real casual and real breezy. Is that something you work on and develop? Is it just kind of who you are? Have you been the same writer more or less since you were coming up through the ranks?
I never did think I had one of those styles. I agree with you. You know, you always knew Riles. I mean, there were certain things as a writer you could do good and you could do well, excuse me. And no matter how much I tried, you know, Rick would, Riley would come up with things. There's certain things you can't do. I think maybe the key is recognizing your weaknesses. Rick and Dan Jenkins and those guys were always good at metaphors. You know, I dropped that quicker than third period French. You know,
right,
I mean,
right.
That wasn't my thing. I thought that I was good when I could make a description and not just kind of play it out a little bit. I remember thinking that when I was looking at Jerry West right away and thinking. And we were talking about L.A. You know, we were in L.A. L.A.'s part of a character, the story. Well, he doesn't look like a leading man. You know, he looks like somebody that looks like somebody that, you know, is a stuntman. You know, he looks more like a stuntman. So I knew that somewhere in there I had to kind of get that in. And I don't think it's something that I really think about. And I would, you know, I'm pleased that you think I would have a distinctive style, but I never thought I had one of those. Like, Russian was wordplay. You know, Riles was, Riles was the metaphors that strung together, you know, quickly. Gary Smith was burrowing inside of someone with a
right.
kind of second person self-examination. But I don't know. I just never thought I had that. I can tell you this. It doesn't come out right away. You got to come back. You got to go back. I write pretty fast, I would say, and I get a lot of stuff down quickly, probably before most writers do. But then I go back an awful, awful, awful lot. I'm not one of those guys that polishes page one before I go on to page two. Page one might be a mess, and I might get from page one to page 15 quicker than anybody, but I'm going back a lot to see what's in there. So it does take some work.
Do you like writing? Like, do you enjoy the process of actually writing?
I do. You know, when I talk to my classes or make a talk, I always say that, you know, there's two, as you know, you when you were at SI or you're researching books, I mean, there are two really distinct processes. And there's not, it's almost like, I know you hate golf, but it's almost like putting and driving. The right. two have nothing to do with it. I mean, the strokes are completely different. Reporting to me has always been not arduous, but it's the thing to me that's the hardest. I mean, once I get to the people, it's easy. You know, I think I'm a pretty good interviewer, but you know, you got to get them in the right. You got to get a hold of them. You got to get enough time. You got to get them in the right place. You got to get them in the right mood. You got to get them without distractions. Those kind of variables, they always change. I mean, I could be talking to Jerry West. We're going along good in a hotel, and all of a sudden, nine people come in and interrupt us,
right.
you know, because they see him. Now the train of thought is going. Or an athlete in a locker room, as you know, always the worst place to get him. So trying to get an athlete, trying to get your subject to talk in a place where he or she can talk comfortably, that never gets easier. That always is a variable. But writing, once you get the information, you know, writing isn't as much of a variable. I mean, I can go down to my little place at the Jersey Shore and close myself up and do it. And I'm not saying it comes easy, because that would be stupid, but it probably comes. I probably am a little blessed with maybe it becoming a little bit easier. And I do think, you know, I have gotten that's just as good as I got older. You start to worry about, you know, losing your fastball when you get to my age, simply because people are asking you about it.
Right.
You know, but I don't think that's happened yet. I hope it hasn't.
You, I always thought you were really, really, really strong at, this is kind of from afar, at engaging with people, as far as you never seem, I could be totally off on this. You never seemed intimidated by athletes. You never seem nervous about going up to a Barkley or a Jordan or a Magic or a Bird. Whereas when I was covering baseball at SI, I always felt like I had a lot of tiptoe in me. Like, I would enter a locker room and there would be some tiptoeing, like nervousness, walking up quiet. I don't know. I always, am I wrong here? I always felt like you just had a real sense of self.
I think partly it was the sport, Jeff. I mean, I remember the few times I did baseball. It's a different vibe.
Yeah,
it is a different, a part of what you say is true, and I'll address it, but part of it is baseball, or, you know, I just found hard the times I had to do it. I mean, obviously Tommy Verducci hasn't and Tim Kirchen hasn't,
right,
because they've worked on it. But I'm just wondering if they, I remember when Steve Wolf, who was a great baseball writer, Steve went over to do some, and that's how he made his bones, and I guess probably that's still his sport. I remember him transferring over to, well, not transferring, but he did a couple bonus pieces on basketball one time. And I remember him calling me and going, This is unbelievable. this is like another world. Yeah, come on in. Yeah, I'll talk to you.
Right.
Sure.
Right.
So I think the sport doesn't mean there's not pricks in basketball, doesn't mean there's not great guys in baseball, and maybe that's even changed a little bit. Maybe there's more now. But I think that's number one, that it has grown up, that basketball just developed with more of a media-friendly thing. The other thing is I always thought the gap between journalist and subject was more pronounced as with age rather than fame. When I was 21 or 22, I was assigned to go up and interview the Lehigh football coach, which was a guy named Fred Dunlap. I'm 21 years old. I'm going up to interview the Lehigh football coach. This was like an older boy going to talk to the Pope.
Right.
I mean, that's what I remember feeling. And when I got to SI, I was 31. And when I got the NBA beat, I was 35. Well, you know, by that time, you're a little bit older. And certainly part of it is just pretending you feel more comfortable than you do. I was pretty good at feeling comfortable once I got there, or pretending that I did. You know, I was pretty good at that, but I was a little bit older than you when I was doing this, so I think that's a factor.
Did you not find the locker room an intimidating place?
Oh yeah, no, yeah. More intimidating because, as you know, at SI, you know what you were always supposed to do back in the heyday was your whole thing was to get something nobody else got.
Right.
And you couldn't do that in the locker room. I mean, I remember when I first got to SI, I did a lot of college football. And I remember just hours and hours just waiting out. So I would find out who the subject's parents were because the kid would come out and talk to them afterward, you know.
Yeah.
And I would just go wait with the parents, introduce myself, ingratiate myself. You know, well, is Herschel coming out to say, and then only getting those 2 minutes, you know, when he hugged mom or something like that. But for this book, it's funny that I rarely went. I mean, I did for the finals, but, you know, I went to a lot of Golden State Warrior games and the stuff before the game, watching them warm up, the little interplays of the teammates, the things Steve Kerr would talk about, that was much more important to me than, well, there were times I didn't even go in the locker room afterward.
Right. You know,
because what do I care about what somebody said about a December game? Things have happened in locker room that have blossomed into stories. You know, once, you know, you can get some stuff in there. But by and large, the locker room was never a sports writer's favorite place to visit, I don't think.
Right. Well, when you were working on this book, like, is it possible in this era of just uber coverage of everything that you would be able to get something from Steph Curry that nobody else has?
The only thing I could get from him, it wouldn't be something from his private life. The only thing I really wanted, I was, you know, in one way, this is the most broad Steph Curry subject, shooting. But the only thing you can do is pick out a certain subject you want to talk about and just try to microscope the crap out of it. And I remember asking him, when's the first time he took one of these long shots? And I just, not that this is a great revelation,
right,
but Steph started telling me about this game in college when he all of a sudden came down and just said, what the hell? And he threw one up. There was a set play that he was supposed to run at Davidson, and he just threw one up and it went in. And it was sort of like, I thought, that's almost the only kind of nuggets you can
right,
you can get these days. I mean, I spent, you know, the bar, unfortunately, for me, was set, you know, when I did the Phoenix Suns book, 7 seconds or less. I mean, they basically, they opened up the locker room.
Right.
I mean, it was like I was on the team, and I will never, and so I measure every experience against that. And frankly, come up lacking because I will never get that again. I mean, obviously the Warriors, I ask about it, but they're not opening up the right locker room to anybody anymore. I don't know whether anybody will ever do that. If you do, if you get that opportunity and you can't write a good book, honestly, you shouldn't be in the business.
Why did the Suns give you that access?
You know, it was just this weird set of circumstances. Julie Fye, the public relations director, one of the best in the business, Julie kind of trusted me. I had known her for a lot of years. It was at a time when D'Antoni's team was just taking off. They were becoming the darlings of the NBA. And I think they felt a little bit, hey, you know, we're not quite getting this notice. Maybe this might be fun. They weren't jaded. They weren't in a city like New York. You went to a Suns practice, and there was a normal number of people there. They had two newspapers. That's it. It was a little bit before social media went insane. You know, there weren't 27 websites there.
Right.
So it was a perfect time for a team that people really liked, was a premier team with premier players, but yet did not come across as a premier. It just didn't have the media following of a premier team, of a New York, of a Los Angeles, even of a Chicago. The other thing that was going on was there was just an unusual batch of assistant coaches there. Never mind Mike D'Antoni, one of the great guys. Alvin Gentry, number one or two on anybody's great guy list.
Right.
Mark Iveroni, Phil Webb brother, Dan D'Antoni, who was coming into the league new. It was just this perfect match of, you know, the cliche, a perfect storm of coaches, team, and time in the NBA. And I was lucky to have plugged into that.
Now, let's say you're doing that book and, I don't know, you find out that Amari Stoudemire has a hooker in his room every night. I'm just being hypothetical here. Like, do you have their trust, the PR person sort of trusts you. Are there things you have to ignore, or are there, you know, are there conditions that come with the idea that we are going to give you this access?
They didn't. It was funny. They weren't really spelled out with the I had told them. I can't remember whether I told the. I mean, if I told somebody, maybe I told Steve Nash. I said this is supposed to be a book about how a team operates basketball wise. And I just wasn't comfortable. First of all, I wasn't comfortable, number one. Number two, my age, you know, at that point, it was 10 years, you know, I'm 56, 57. I didn't want to be trailing. I didn't want to be having beers with Raja Bell. You know, right. That wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to be in the film sessions with the coach. I wanted the coaches. I wanted to hear about what they were saying to game plan. Mm-hmm. That was sort of the premise of the book. There were about six or seven or eight times during the season where D'Antoni would just say to me, there were a lot of times I wrote something that he didn't like, but, you know, him and Raja Bell had a fight, and this isn't getting away from your question. So the answer to your question more was the more salacious things that you would undoubtedly find out about a team. Number one, I didn't explore them to find out. And number two, I probably wouldn't have written them anyway unless they sort of begun to impact the team. But Mike would just reach certain points when he'd look at me, goes jokingly with a smile on his face, if you write that, I'll kill you.
Like, so he had a fight with Raja Bell. Did you did use it?
Yeah, I did. It was at halftime, and it was a kind of a like a fascinating fight. They were hollering at each other, you know.
Right.
Actually, it might have been after the game. I don't know. But I'm sitting there with my tape recorder out. And a lot of things with Sean Marion, I know in retrospect, Mike wished I hadn't written. But of the salacious, you know, sleeping with prostitutes type of thing, staying out late, I just kind of stayed away from it. I just felt that I wasn't the one to do that book. It didn't feel to me. It just turned out as a really, really, really inside basketball type of book.
Right, right. You spent almost 30 years at SI. I only spent, I think, 6 years at SI. The magazine recently announced that next year, I think it's going 27 issues. It's thinner than it's ever been. Print clearly is not on the rise. I guess it's like a broadly in question. How do you feel about this all? Because it kind of breaks my heart, but maybe you see things differently.
Well, selfishly, number one, the first thing I think, and this is totally selfish, was you get very few advantages of being, in your upper 60s, you know, health-wise, mm-hmm. you know, the way your knees feel and all that crap. But one of the things that I can be thankful of, as can Bill Mack, as can Curry Kirkpatrick, probably, Frank DeFord, who bless his heart, has passed on, is that we came along at the right time. I mean, I was at SI when it was not one of the great, but when it was one of the great magazines of the world.
Right.
I mean, it was a boon for advertisers. It was a boon for subscribers. It was a boon for journalism. The swimsuit issue notwithstanding, and that kind of almost stamped it its own little identity, you know, for better or for worse. So that's the first thing I think of is luck. Number two, I probably think of as you do. It's a little bit sad, but I will say this, and I really mean this. And I talk to young people about this all the time. I was talking to somebody about it yesterday. It's just peculiar that it gets smaller and not as many people read it. But the brand is still so strong. When they do something, it still kind of means something. And this really hit me when I was doing the Warriors book. When I do, the Warriors part of this book, whenever, and I'm just not saying this because they're my friends. I bet you're going to agree with me. Lee Jenkins or Chris Ballard would come out to do something, you know, and they'd be doing the same thing I do, interviewing the same people, getting to Curry, getting whatever they were doing. And it would come out and it was so goddamn good.
Yeah.
You know, it was just made me feel, wow, this is the bar that I used to have to meet, you know, every like week. These were the guys I was like writing against. And so still the level of journalism that comes out of there, it's just an inexplicable phenomenon how that continues to exist. But yet the importance of the magazine and the size of the magazine goes down. And I'm not sure. I mean, I guess we could go back to the roots of the internet, but I'm not sure it's anything that SI did other than a temper of the times. But selfishly, obviously, I was there at the right time and worked with so many incredible people there.
Yeah, I remember when I was covering baseball early on, and Michael Bamberger, I was talking to him about travel, and he said, he goes, I just think when I book travel for a story, I want to be as comfortable on the road as I should be at home. So he'd be like, you just book whatever hotel you want, you know, just book whatever hotel you want. And I'd be staying in like these $250, $300 a night hotels, I came late. I got there in 96, but it was like you were kind of the man working at SI and walking into a locker room with a SI media credential and, oh, when do you want to talk to him? And how much time do you need with him? Oh, Gary Sheffield. Yeah, we'll get him for you. No problem. And I just feel like people don't realize, younger writers coming up now, don't realize the swag that came with being at SI back in the day.
Well, they do when we start talking about it. But yeah. I always called it the Shutters phenomenon. You know, Shutters out in LA, you know, in Santa Monica. It was a great Walter Yost hotel. It was, you know, the great photographer. Walter told me about it, and I just loved Shutters. Shutters wasn't, you know, it wasn't $600 back then, but it was $250, $300, you know, something like that. And I remember I was working a story about sports movies, and I was in LA for like 4 or 5 days, and I remember getting a call from the expense people when things were starting to change, and I was sitting in the middle of my Shutter suite, and the person said, well, you know, there's going to be no more Shutters. And I said, well, I guess I better extend my stay here by a day. Yeah. Too, you know? So, but you did, it did spoil you, you know, it did spoil you a little bit, because I mean, I was a bargain rate guy when I first got to SI. I had come from newspapers, you know, where I had 2 years before I got to SI, I mean, I was making $14,000 a year, which even in 1979 was not much money. You didn't even stay. I covered the state wrestling tournaments. At, you know, I went back and forth two times, a 320-mile round trip, you know, without staying in a hotel. So, you know, yeah, I had some adjustments to make when I got to SI, but it kind of spoiled you because now that I'm semi-retired and a lot of times have to spend my own dime.
You're back at the Holiday Inn.
Yeah. My wife says, well, we can just stay here. I go, no, I'm not staying there. we're gonna go up to 275, even though we could get this for 175. No, we're going to go up to the 275 because you do get used to it.
You are affected. You are affected by this sway of SI.
No doubt.
Did you, when Sports Illustrated famously ran the cover with Michael Jordan, Bag It Michael, and then he wouldn't talk to the magazine for forever and ever, you were the NBA writer. How crippling was that to your job?
Actually, I had just gotten off it. The one who had to go through it the most was Phil Taylor.
Oh, yeah.
I had had a couple of years when I was a scorecard editor. And one of the reasons I left there for a while, I had just done Shaq Attack, as you mentioned, right. And Magic was Larry had retired. Michael had stepped away from the game. Magic, it turned out, was going through his HIV thing. It turned out he did not play anymore. And something had gone out of the game. And I did this book on Shaq, and I didn't want to just be the kind of guy, you know, geez, I did this first-person book with Shaq, and now I'm Shaq's guy. And I just thought I needed to step away. And that's right when they did that headline. So I didn't see Michael. I know Phil Taylor had to go through it, a great Phil Taylor who followed me. And I didn't, but then a couple of years later, I had to go out and do something on Michael. And that's the first time I had seen him. And I found out for sure that no, he wouldn't. He used to talk to me. And then I got back on the beat at the last tail end when he was with the Wizards. And when I was researching the Dream Team book, you know, I called up his person. And I said, hey, tell Michael it's got nothing to do with Sports Illustrated. They're not publishing it. I'm semi-retired. And I didn't tell him I was still on the masthead, but I'm basically gone. And, you know, Michael talked to me for, you know, an hour and 20 minutes. It was great.
Do you think he was, was that an example of a guy being overly thin-skinned, or did he have reason, do you think, to be pissed?
He had reason to be pissed, but I think that at that time, his pride was hurt because nobody had ever tell him, you shouldn't be doing this. You know, you're bringing shame upon, you shouldn't be doing this. I think one of the things that was, you know, Michael had gradually was on this decline of making himself available. Mm-hmm. And I think partly this was a reason. This was just another thing that would keep him from talking, that would give him a little more distance from giving interviews. And I think that was part of it also. You know, Sports Illustrated, I can't remember whether you were there then, in 1999, had this turn of the century party.
Yeah.
And, you know, they basically got everybody there. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And I remember I wrote a note to Michael, and he basically showed up, I think, more because of Walter Yost, the photographer, that I think Walter called him, and they had done some book projects together, mm-hmm. and he really respected Walter. And I remember going up to Michael at the thing that night and saying, hey, man, glad you could make it or something. He goes, yeah, well, you know, I wouldn't be here. I wasn't going to come, but I didn't want to disappoint Walter. Him and Walter had a lot of, in other words, he was telling me he didn't come because of me. You know, he wasn't there because of me, and he wasn't there to be a good guy. But that was an interesting night because I did see the guy's fame at that point, because the two athletes, and I'm telling you, everybody was there. Mm-hmm. We're talking Nicholas Palmer, everybody. Everybody came except for Spitz, yep. The swimmer, yep. Who wanted money. The two most charismatic characters there for the other athletes were Ali and Michael Jordan.
Wow.
They were the two guys that even Jack Nicholson, Palmer kind of, look like they were subservient. Subservient's the wrong word, but look like they, were lesser lights than Jordan and Ali. They were the stars.
Is it weird to you that Michael Jordan is 54 years old? Like, does that sound weird or does that sound right?
Well, when I tell you how, when I'm 69, that doesn't sound, sound too weird. I guess a little bit. Yeah. When you think of it, you tend to think of athletes in there. One of the good things about covering the NBA and still being around was that the number of people that are still around, Steve Kerr's one of the, busiest guys in the league. He's coaching this premier team. He's ducking in and out with this terrible injuries he's had. Well, I knew Steve back when he was a Bull and knew him when he was a San Antonio Spur.
Right.
It's easy to get to him. Or same thing with Greg Popovich doesn't talk very much, but I really wanted to talk to him about the way the Warriors run their offense. So it's just easier if you've had a relationship with somebody. And in the NBA, they seem to kind of respect those relationships, that if you've been around for, I'm sure it works, the same way in any other sport, but it was very fortunate for someone who's not on the beat anymore and who really hasn't been for a while. It's very fortunate that you can feel reintegrated when you come back. That not only psychologically makes you feel good, but pragmatically, you can get your work done easier than if you are coming in, drifting in from another planet somewhere.
Yeah, that makes sense. I wasn't going to ask you about this story. In fact, I totally forgot about it. And midway through this interview, I was like, wait a second. Here's a lead to a story you're going to know as soon as I read the lead, even though it's 31 years old. There wasn't a happier young athlete in America than Len Bias on the afternoon of June 17th. You wrote a story. This wasn't your first cover story, was it, Len Bias? Death of a Dream?
No, it wasn't my first cover story. No, I had written maybe the worst cover story in the history of Sports Illustrated about Marvis Frazier, Joe Frazier's son, but that's another question. They wanted to put him on the cover. They wanted to put Marvis Frazier on the cover. I said, he's not very good, and I don't think the story's very good,
but I'll take it.
They wanted to put him on the cover, but anyway.
But I'll take that cover if you want to give it to me. The Len Bias story, I remember, so I was, I don't want to make you feel old, I was 14 when this came out, and I remember, the death of Len Bias, who for people who don't know, was a star of Maryland and the number two pick in the 86 NBA draft by the Boston Celtics, and he died the night of the draft, I believe, from cocaine. There's stories in life that stick with you. Am I naive in thinking this is one that probably stuck with you a little bit?
Oh yeah. I mean, it was, I remember sitting there and reading it. And I do remember it being a writing lesson because, it was so, the events were so dramatic. I mean, there's somebody, you were 14, you remembered. I still get, people still comment on that story. They still, every year, the anniversary of it, somebody brings it up. It was just some moment. Because it was just such a, Len Bias, whether or not it was the first time he took cocaine, who knows? Maybe it was the fourth, but it was so shocking because it happened hours after this kid was going to come into the league. By all accounts, he was going to replace who knows whether he would replace Larry Bird, but he was going to be the next rung on that ladder. Larry was already starting to think about it. Larry's back was already starting to hurt him. He was going to be, he was going to be a superstar. And it just really hit people. And I remember sitting there, writing this story in a hotel room down in Maryland and thinking, the more dramatic the story, the more dramatic the events of the story, the less you have to make it dramatic.
Right.
And I just remember writing that first sentence, like there wasn't a happier young man in America than. So you were sort of like once upon a time. And I tell my students this, it sounds corny, but try to make everything a story. Once upon a time, there was a something or other who had, you know, that you almost think of in this very simplistic thing. All right, you're going to tell me a story. You can't get bogged down by the emotion of it. You just got to start this story someplace. And I do, you know, very vividly remember starting it that way. And once you start with a simple and you understand you're going to tell this story, it's a little bit easier for everything to just follow. It's not always that easy, but that is something to untangle it once in a while. You almost think about the once upon a time structure.
Is it? It's funny, over the years, so Bias would have been 54, which is also mind-boggling if you were
That's
alive.
Actually more mind-boggling.
Right, because he's stuck in time as his 22-year-old
stuck
kid.
In time.
Whenever people talk about Len Bias or when he comes up, people say, oh, he would have been this, he would have been this, he would have been, you know, blah, 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 and the Celtic. Is it possible he just would have been Craig Elo, you know, or Tim Hardaway Jr., or do you feel like this guy was going to be a great, great player?
I do. I do feel that. He had every, I mean, if you see the clips of him and you get the ferocity of his competitiveness also. And he was a baller. I mean, he was a playground guy. He was a nut. He was a rat. You know, yeah. he wasn't going to mail it in. I mean, how do you know? Of course, you never know. But to me, I would fall on the side of what everybody says. That to me is look like what he was going to be. It's funny, you know, okay, why wasn't he the first pick? I mean, it just shows what was going on back then, that still teams, you know, right up through Greg Oden and Kevin Durant, we still need the big center, yeah. You know, because Brad Daugherty was the first pick. And
right.
I remember thinking that, no way. The game has just started to change too much. No way. Len Bias is going to be better than Brad Daugherty, but that's something we shall never know.
And Brad Daugherty had a pretty good career.
Oh, of course he did.
Yeah.
Of course he did. You know, Sam Bowie didn't even have that pick before Michael Jordan didn't even have that bad a career beside the injuries that befell him.
Yeah, that was an interesting draft because I always thought, I remember being a kid and loving the Nets, and they drafted Pearl Washington. And I thought we had the new Magic Johnson on our team, and that did not happen.
No, he had about his problem was he had about 7 fewer inches and 50 more pounds.
Yeah, I remember.
Than Magic.
Yeah. Well, Jack, listen, I as always, I appreciate your insights and your help, and you know, congratulations with the new book, and thank you for taking the time and doing this. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you. You are Mr. Bumpers. I'm attempting to. I think I'm going to send out a few bumpers out there, due to your example in this new form of social media communication.
You know, I'm happy to be a role model in any possible way. So if that means bumpers, I'm happy with it.
All right. Good enough.
All right. Thanks, Jack.
Thanks, Jeff.
I want to thank today's guest, Jack McCallum, for joining me on Two Writers Thing and Yang. You can visit Jack's website at jackmccallum.net and follow him on Twitter at McCallum12. One can listen to Two Writers Thing and Yang on both iTunes and on bumpers.fm. Reviews are always appreciated. Music, again, is from the sizzling MC White Owl. Thanks for joining me. And remember, keep writing.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.